I become fixated on her words. I have a child. My mind snaps back at her sarcastically. No, you have three children. But then again, I don't think of her as my mother, so why would she think of me as her child? Because, shouldn't you always remember your children? I never had the luxury of forgetting a woman I've never met, a vague figure of a mother mostly invented or derived from old, yellowed Polaroids of Evelyn's old friends that I found in her closet. I flipped through them like I was shuffling cards, greedily pawing until the women's faces were smudged with tiny fingerprints. I always wondered if one of them was my real mother. I could never bring myself to ask. Caroline had easily forgotten us. The evidence is right here. I have a child. I realized then, her darting eyes, her fidgeting, her reluctance to talk to me, she was afraid. But also maybe, just maybe, relieved. The decision was made for her. Who can blame her now? I stand up. But you did. You did talk to me. Why? I swallow. Out of nowhere, I want to cry. I feel the bite in the back of my throat. I owe you. I owe Evelyn, I guess? Joan? I'm sorry. Whether you believe that or not. She rocks back on her heels. I have to go. I think of Cash in the car. The faceless, nameless man who threatened Caroline. Later, the way she'd surely be watching out her curtains all night. I hitch my purse high on my shoulder and it swings back, knocking over the half-full water glass. Water edges down the sides of the table and on the floor, creeping toward the rich, leathery sofa. I suppress the urge to apologize. Caroline's eyes dart from me to the puddle and back, and I know she is struggling over which is a larger disaster. She stands woodenly in the living room, eyes closed. Zoe, she says softly. I stand there expectantly, stupidly still hoping for something, a hug, an apology, a gesture of kindness. Friendship? Don't ever come back. I climb into the passenger side and slam the door. Cash had reclined his seat and is startled awake. He shakes the sleep from his eyes.
Already? What happened?
He adjusts the backrest upright. She was threatened, I blurt. He cocks his head, confused. I take the card with Joan's information and flash it in front of his face. Also, I have a sister. If he's shocked, it doesn't register on his face. He just nods.
Did you know? I demand.
He shakes his head.
No, Zoe, I swear I had no idea.
He turns the key in the ignition and backs slowly out of the driveway. He keeps his eyes forward, trained on the road.
What happened with Caroline?
She's a bitch.
I say it forcefully, partly because I'm tugging on the seatbelt and it finally breaks loose, but the curse slips out easily and it feels good. Even as I say it, I know it's not completely true. It occurs to me then, even without the threatening phone call, would the outcome have been any different? She didn't stay in touch with Joan. She has a new life. I don't fit in. You were right. Is that what you want to hear? I huff and sit back, crossing my ankles.
No. Zoe, I'd hoped I was wrong. You know that, right? What did she say?
He shifts uncomfortably as he puts the car in drive. Cash, she got a phone call. Someone threatened her if she talked to me. We're stopped at an intersection, and he turns to look at me, his mouth hanging open.
What? Who called her?
I have no idea. I shrug. Here's the weird part. My sister, Joan, she knows I exist. She found my mother, our mother, 3 years ago. Evelyn had no idea that Joan even existed. The whole thing is fucked up.
I'll admit that's odd.
He rubs his chin.
Will you look for her, Joan?
I don't have to look for her. Caroline gave me her address. I wave the card in front of him again, blocking his view of the road. He swats it away.
So what do you want to do now?
I think about it for a minute. Honestly, I want to find Joan. I want to meet her.
Right now?
He gives me a sideways smile. My anger is like an ocean swell, forceful and overwhelming one minute, receding to calm the next. I watch as we turn the corner off Caroline Street, and her house fades from view. I feel a small prick of fear. Who called her? Then a crazy idea. Could she be lying? Yeah, would that be awful, to just show up, I wonder out loud?
Maybe. I think you should call first.
I let that sit, thinking about what I care more about. My sister's comfort level, or my increasingly desperate need to see her. We drive in silence, merge onto I-84 West, and just like that, my mother is gone. Whatever tether I've had is dissolved. And I poke at this feeling. Repeat the words in my mind. I explore it, the way your tongue finds a hole in your mouth where a tooth once was. I can't decide if I care. A small part of me worries for her, that whispered threat, for her and her little boy and her accountant husband. Thanks for coming with me. This has to be so boring for you. I avoid his gaze by staring at the trees that whiz past the passenger side window.
Are you kidding? I've said this before, but what I cover daily, it's nothing that gets your blood pumping. This is interesting, Zoe.
Reminds me of my Texas days. He taps the steering wheel.
Who called Caroline? Why would anyone threaten her?
I think of the break-in, the careening car, the overwhelming feeling that I'm on some kind of runaway train, that my whole life, the penthouse apartment, the perfect marriage, the money and security, is about to come crashing down around me. I've been too complacent, which never goes unpunished. It's all been too lucky, too happenstance. Something is going on, buzzing just under the surface, and I can't figure it out.
Do you wonder why she hasn't called you? He asks, evenly.
Who, Joan? She must have her reasons, I say a tad snappily, trying to figure out what those reasons might be. Maybe she has a family, or a crappy relationship, or in general, a busy life. Maybe she's an ad executive, or she works nights trying to make ends meet. Who knows? There could be a thousand reasons. People typically believe they have all the time in the world to accomplish things. There are a lot of theoretical some days.
That's true.
He raises his eyebrow in my direction. You don't believe it, I say, but he just shrugs.
Who called Caroline?
He comes back to that. My head pounds, I'm so tired. Joan and Caroline and some whispered threatening phone call? It's all too much. I study his profile, his long straight nose, his clear intelligent green eyes with a compassionate twinkle, his skin, rough and uneven, presumably from too many days in the hot Texas sun investigating the newest political scandal. I know nothing about you, I say, realizing that it's true.
You've never asked, Cash says with a sideways smile and a quick flicker of a glance.
I feel my cheeks flush. He's right. I haven't. Our friendship started because you were writing a story on me. It's not really conducive to a two-way conversation. I'm justifying myself. Our friendship, if you can call it that, has been shamefully focused on me. He laughs.
Touché. So, ask away. I'll answer.
How did you end up back on the East Coast? He shifts in his seat and cocks his head.
Go right for the hard stuff, eh?
Is it? I thought that was a softball. I smile.
Yeah, well, you didn't know. So, I was engaged. Her name was Mary. We met at an Astros game. Actually, Game 5 of the NLCS in 2005.
He coughs and shifts in the driver's seat.
I was sitting behind her, and we were all standing and jumping around because Berkman had just hit a home run. And some jerk knocked into me, spilling my beer all down her back. She turned around and took one look at me holding an empty beer cup and threw her daiquiri in my face. Who drinks a daiquiri at a baseball game?
I think I said that. I bought her another one as a peace offering. As he tells the story, he gets a funny, faraway look, and I think of all the ways Cash has held himself at arm's length. Although I'm married, I feel certain it wouldn't be different if I wasn't.
I've never been to a baseball game.
Never? You've lived in New York for how long and you've never gone to a Mets or a Yankees game? That's like un-American.
I know. I guess just it wasn't Lydia's thing, and it's certainly not Henry's thing. I think his firm has had events at Yankee Stadium, but we haven't gone. I flick my fingertips in his direction. I didn't mean to hijack the conversation. Keep going. This Mary, she liked your daiquiri, then?
Oh, sure. Who wouldn't?
He winks at me and I laugh.
So, I got to plead my case, that it wasn't my fault, ruffians and all that. She believed me, I guess. I saw her later at a bar outside the stadium and bought her another daiquiri. We met for dinner the following Saturday. She was...
I give Cash his reverent moment. Beautiful, amazing, luminous.
Batshit crazy. That's what she was. She was a lawyer, an attack dog in the courtroom. She got an offer from a New York law firm after killing them in an insurance case. She drove a hard bargain and walked away a partner and a rich woman. I followed her here. I was a journalist. There had to be a ton of work in New York, right? I was working freelance, but she didn't think I had a lot of ambition and suggested the Post as a way to be more structured with my life. A real job, she called it.
Huh, is all I can think to say.
Yeah, huh. But I did. And we had a spacious high-rise on Fifth Avenue, overlooking Central Park. She worked long hours, so I started working long hours. I proposed to her to fix it, which is just about the dumbest thing a person can do. She said yes because, well, I don't know why. I surprised her at work one night to find her screwing one of the partners in her office. Wouldn't you lock the door? He offers a quick glance over. I'd lock the door. I mean, come on.
Ouch. He sighed.
So I moved out and haven't spoken to her since. Oh.
He snaps his fingers like he just remembered something.
That's a lie. I covered a wedding a few years ago, and she was there as a guest. With him. She married that guy. She was all tucked and lifted. Her face was a thick cake of makeup. She was like an ice sculpture of Mary. When I said I still worked at the Post, she laughed.
What did you say? I ask, incredulous.
I asked her if she still fucked her husband in her office. He was standing right there, and by the look on his face, I could tell that answer was no.
I laughed. So you're not still hung up on her? He's quiet for a moment.
No, not hung up on her. She was the only woman I was ever engaged to, so sometimes I wonder. Plus, she was such a loose cannon. I find myself sabotaging relationships with other women, that's all. They're all so normal. Am I self-destructive? My mother thinks so.
Maybe a little bit. It feels so nice to swing the camera around and focus on someone else's problems.
Well, self-destruction seems to be something we have in common.
He turns the radio on, but to a low volume. Something classical.
More surprises. How did you end up on the East Coast?
The question is tangled up in the things I cannot say. I think of how to be honest, truthful, and not give away all my secrets. For me, the basest act is also the most admissible. Evelyn. I was in college. I was in a bad place. I trace swirl patterns with my fingertip on the cold window pane. My adoptive mother, Evelyn, she died. I was depressed and too poor to take care of her, so I ran away.
She was sick?
She had cancer. I try to avoid saying it, that big looming pit of blackness in the corner of my mind, the one that I skirt around with euphemisms and niceties like common burial and state-funded, when I really mean abandoned, unloved. So, New York was an escape for me. I saw an opening at Le Fleur de Lys and started working there as a glorified custodian. I worked on design at night. Then, I met Henry. My voice drops on the Henry. The thing is, I left my mother. I square my shoulders and stare at Cash's profile, willing him to pass judgment. I see nothing, not a flicker of understanding even.
in the morgue. I couldn't afford to bury her. I left her.
I see comprehension dawning in his eyes. He reaches out, touches my hand.
Are you that same person?
No. I was a mess then, running from myself, from other people. I'm only a slightly more put-together mess now. I pat my running nose with a napkin I find in the glove box.
Have you tried to go back?
Find out what the county did? I can do that for you. You could have a memorial.
Have closure.
No, I can't. I shake my head vehemently. They did a state-funded burial. That's what they give to people who are abandoned. The only people who are abandoned in death are those who die unloved. I can't finish my sentence. I can't even finish the thought, except I push. My brain pushes past the whooshing in my ears, and the whir of the tires on the road, and the awareness of my body, and I think the thought I've avoided since I left San Francisco 5 years ago. The last thing I ever did to Evelyn was tell her that she was unloved. The words themselves don't feel so terrible out there, clunked out on the console between us. Cash covers my hand with his, and his eyes are so filled with compassion that I think I might break, right there in that shitty car on I-84. I gaze out onto the interstate in front of us, a large flat expanse of nothingness with no cars and no people. It's all so lonely. I depress the window button and feel the warm air hit my face. I take some deep breaths. I've said the worst things about myself to someone who seems to care about me, and I'm still here. My hands are trembling, and I shove them under my thighs, my diamond digging into my skin. Cash reaches over, taps my shoulder.
Okay.
I nod awkwardly. I feel like someone who has impulsively confessed something horrible on a crashing plane that ends up righting itself only minutes later. I cough.
Yeah.
I want to find out information on Joan. How can I do that?
Do you have a computer?
He asks. I give him a duh look and he laughs.
If you give me 15 minutes and decent Wi-Fi, I can find out pretty much anything.
I shrug. Okay, let's go. But I'm taking advantage of Henry being gone and ordering Chinese for dinner. He generally considers all takeout to be the lowest form of food, barely edible.
Well, that's a real shame. I happen to love chicken and broccoli.
We order takeout and sit on a blanket on the living room floor, surrounded by foil and cardboard containers, the sauce oozing out of the corners. I eat until I could burst, and we chat about the city, being transplants, and what things were hardest to get used to.
The speed of everything,
Cash said without thinking.
Everyone walks fast, the subways are fast, the taxis are fast, and yet it can still take an hour to cross a 1 mile island. Why? It used to be frustrating. About 18 months here, I stopped trying to figure it out.
Yes. For me, the hardest part was the massive amounts of people. I come from a city, but San Francisco has nothing on New York in terms of sheer number of bodies. But no one looks at each other. In California, people are nice. I pour us both a glass of wine in the supplied paper cups. I met Lydia, and it got easier. I had a ready-made band of misfits.
Well, it was easier for me at first, then lonely later. I have friends now, guys at the paper or from the gym.
What about girlfriends now? I blurt. He shrugs and leans back against the easy chair behind him.
I do okay.
He rubs his hand across his jaw and gives me a sideways grin. I briefly think of Henry. He would die if he saw us eating in here. The rug cost $5,000. To cover the silence, I reach into the greasy bag and pull out a fortune cookie. I crack it open, the crumbs dusting down to my legs, onto the blanket. I pull out the little folded rectangle of paper. In case of fire, keep calm, pay bill, and run, I read. What does that even mean?
I like how they tell you to pay the bill first, though.
He stretches his legs out and grabs a cookie.
Here's one. It never pays to kick a skunk. Honestly, these are the weirdest fortune cookies I've ever seen.
Kick a skunk? Oh my God, that's ridiculous. Okay, here's one. I unfold another little paper and drop it. We both reach for it, and his hand accidentally grabs mine. I pull it away. The greatest risk is not taking one. We both ponder that one. Cash smiles.
I guess we should get a move on our search for Joan, then.
I laugh as he pulls the last cookie from the bag, cracks it open, and unfolds the fortune. His smile falters. What? Read it.
Zoe, you are extraordinarily beautiful.
What? The flush creeps up my neck and my cheeks grow warm. I clutch the collar of my shirt.
That's what it says. Look.
He hands it to me. He's right. You are extraordinarily beautiful. My pulse thumps under my thumb. I feel it then, his crush on me. We don't know each other enough for it to be any more than that. But I've been abusing his friendship, pretending the undercurrent wasn't there. Why else does a man go to such lengths for a woman, driving her 100 miles in one day? Cash, I...
Did you hear that?
Cash whispers. He holds up his hand, and then I do hear it. A single bang coming from the kitchen fire exit. All penthouses in New York must have a secondary exit. It's part of the fire code. The door back there is locked with a key, not a card the way the front door is, and it's rarely used. The only key that I know of is in the kitchen drawer. I stand up, all wine-fueled courage, and tiptoe toward the kitchen. The room is dark, and light filters in from underneath the emergency door. The light in that hallway is bluish fluorescent and gives the kitchen an eerie glow. I scoot along the cabinets, my back against the countertop. Underneath the door, I can make out the shadow of 2 feet. I can't breathe. My heart pounds. We have got to get out of here. I'm staring at the door, my feet rooted to the marble floor in terror when the door handle jiggles. I back up and crash into one of the metal kitchen stools. The door handle stops moving.
Henry? Is that you?
I yell at the door. My words dribble out much weaker than I intended. Cash grabs my arm. I hadn't even heard him come into the kitchen.
Zoe, we should get out of here.
He's pulling me out through the front door and into the elevator. The service stairs are on the opposite end of the floor. Whoever was back there could cross the building and surprise us on another floor. Difficult and unlikely, but possible. The elevator door closes and we start to move down.
Why would he come in the back? Does he do that?
I bend over at the waist, trying to catch my breath. My legs feel like jello from the adrenaline. He never has before. It's not Henry. Henry's in Japan by now. I stand upright and dial Henry's number. He picks up after one ring.
Zoe, what's the matter?
I inhale, not expecting him to answer. I sag against the back wall of the elevator as the numbers light up. 10, 9, 8.
Henry, someone is in our apartment. I don't know who.
My voice comes out like a squeak. 4, 3, 2, L.
Zoe, are you okay? I'm in L.A. Should I come home?
I don't know what to say. He shouts into the phone.
Can you hear me? I'm coming home, okay?
I can barely hear him over the blood rushing in my ears. The elevator doors slide open. Chapter 21. The lobby is empty with the exception of Walter, the night doorman.
Call the police, Walter.
I'm out of breath and spin in one direction, then the other, to find where the service stairs come out. I think of my apartment a week ago, a leveled wreck, all our belongings strewn across the floors and furniture. I think of the car, the whispered threat to Caroline. I realize with a sudden thud that none of this is accidental. It's all a deliberate attempt to send me a message.
Are you okay, Mrs. Whittaker?
His brows crease, and he reaches a hand out for the telephone. I shake my head. I can't stay here. Someone tried to break into my apartment. Just call them. I run across the lobby, through the revolving doors, and into the street. The April air is still cool at night, despite the daytime heat wave. and the streets of New York are never quiet. Horns honk, people talk, shout, sing. There is always music. It's a comfort, this never-abating circus.
Where to? Cash huffs behind me, as breathless as I am.
I jog west on Hubert Street, make a quick right onto Collister. Cash follows me, waiting to hear my grand plan. I have no grand plan. Stay alive. That's my plan. My mind is racing. What could anyone possibly want with me at this point? Revenge? The last time they came after me, they wanted to know where Rosie was. They thought I would tell them if they pushed me enough. This felt different. More final, less desperate. There was only one reason anyone would come back for me. Revenge, pure and simple. There were only two people who would want that. Jared Pritchett and Mick Flannery. I stopped in an alley to catch my breath.
I don't have a plan, I say to Cash by way of explanation. I don't really have any place to go, but I have to call people. Officer Yates.
Let's go to my apartment. We can call everyone there.
I think of the floor picnic and the half-empty glasses of wine. What will Penny think when she finds that in the morning? Penny. I need to call Penny. Then I realize that Cash has no idea who Penny is. Okay, your apartment. Let's go. I follow him into the subway station at Canal Street. On the train, I scan up and down looking for anyone suspicious. Jared Pritchett is just a shadowy figure in my mind. Mick's thick blonde hair 5 years later could even be thinning by now. The zigzag purple scar on his cheek that curled along his hairline from where he'd almost lost an ear in prison. I can't recall how I know that story. I was 14 when he was away the first time for about a year. DUI, Evelyn had said. Not his first. His absence both freeing and hollow. The refrigerator devoid of beer, the ashtrays wiped clean and stacked in the kitchen cabinet, waiting for his inevitable return 13 months later. One day he was gone, the apartment sunny and cool, and the next, he was back, the air thick with sweat. He wasn't mean, not always, but his breath smelled like sensen, those red and gold packets stacked like playing cards under the quartz ashtray at the kitchen table. The curling smoke while he and Evelyn played gin rummy. Her high-pitched giggles as the nights wore on. They were mostly happy, until they weren't. I suppose that's true for most everyone. The R train stops at Union Square and we exit without incident. No Jared, no Mick, no one is following us. I'm back to checking over my shoulder again the way I used to, looking for men with guns. The streets are strangely deserted. We walk the 4 Avenue blocks to Cash's apartment. Cash lives in a walk-up, a skinny, flimsy building with no doorman. I eye the window, which looks easy to break, and the deadbolt, which looks barely operational. He ducks his head, shyly, as we enter, and holds his arm out by way of a tour. His apartment is sparse, but small and clean, and his kitchen is an efficiency. The tile linoleum and white steel stove scream 50s. Complete with formica-topped table and red vinyl stools. The living room houses one small plaid love seat and a faux wood entertainment center that even has the back cutout and magnetic doors. A sheet divides the bedroom area from the living room. I can see the whole apartment from the vantage point right inside the door, which could fit in Henry's master bathroom. It's so cozy. I mean that as a compliment. But I can tell by his face that he receives it as an insult.
That's what nice people say when they mean small, he smirks.
No, genuinely. Most days I could lose my mind in Henry's apartment. It's the first time I've ever said it that way. Henry's apartment. It's always been our apartment. I fish my cell phone out of my purse and pull out a kitchen chair. The first phone call I make is to Officer Yates.
Zoe. Her voice is all business. Glad you called, girl. Listen, I found something you should—
Officer Yates, a man tried to break in my apartment tonight. Again. He came up the service steps into the kitchen. I ran, but the doorman called the police. Can you go?
What? Where are you?
I sigh. I'm so tired. I relay the events of the evening, in more detail and slower. I don't tell her about Caroline or the phone call, and I can't decide if I should. It seems excessive, a distraction from everything else that's happened. I can tell her when I see her, which I'm sure I will. She hmms and ahas as I talk. I think she's taking notes. I hear the clicking of her long fingernails on computer keys. She promises she's on her way, and I hear the swoosh of her windbreaker as I imagine her getting up from her chair, motioning to her partner to come with her. The phone disconnects. I dial Henry.
Zoe, where are you? What's going on?
He answers in one sentence, one breath. I close my eyes. Perhaps then he still cares. But do I? It's hard to know. I tell him about the latest break-in, the man at the service door. There are things I haven't told you. I know why all this is happening. There are things you don't know. It comes out of my mouth in a jumble of facts. I testified against some terrible men in California. My testimony put them away for a long time. I can tell you more when you come home. I'm not relaying the entire story now, but I think one or both of them is out of prison and has found me. Someone is trying to scare me. The break-in at the apartment must be connected. And same with that car. Remember, a week ago? It's all just a hunch. I don't tell him about Caroline, about the phone call.
I don't even understand what you're saying. Where are you now?
I'm silent for a moment. Lydia's. The lie slips out easily before I have time to think about it. It just seems easier, I justify, than having him worry the entire time he's on the plane about an affair that's not actually going to happen. Are you coming home or going to Japan? I ask, hopefully. I tap my fingers against my cheek, a nervous gesture I'd seen Evelyn do a million times.
I'm in L.A. right now for a layover, but I'm coming home. My plane boards in...
He's silent for a minute.
10 minutes. I'll be home in 6 hours. It's a red eye.
A chuckle comes through the line, soft and insistent, familiar.
Zoe, I've never taken a red-eye in my life.
Well, I'm honored. We're both quiet, then.
Zoe, I've been so stupid, willfully ignorant of your past, ignoring my past, thinking we can live in this bubble where neither of us has baggage. It's just not real. We'll fix this, okay? Together.
I press the phone tighter against my face, wanting to feel his breath against my cheek, feel his whisper in my ear. My stomach swoops like a roller coaster. I want this love, the one he promises me when we're apart. The love we try to reclaim again and again, chasing it like dandelion seeds. I want that love. A voice blares through the phone, announcing that it's time to board. Henry says a hasty goodbye. I wait until I'm certain he's gone and say, Henry, one more time into the mouthpiece. There's no answer. I miss dial tones. I lay the phone down on the table and wait for cash to come out of the shower. I tiptoe to the kitchen window and peek out through the gingham curtains. Cash's building sits in the middle of 14th Street between 1st and 2nd Avenues. Underneath a storefront awning, front-lit by a street lamp, stands a man smoking a cigarette, a dark baseball cap pulled low over his eyes. I let the curtain fall and edge away from the window. I'm officially back to looking over my shoulder, eyeing every dubious character, doubting every stranger's smile. Suspicion fits me like a glove. Truth be told, I've missed it. Yates calls back and our conversation is brief. They didn't find anyone. Just like last time, it's all inconclusive, and I can hear a thin edge of skepticism in everyone's voice. Yates, Henry, except Cash. Yates asks if I can come in tomorrow for an official interview. The apartment is secured. Someone is watching it. Am I safe? I tell her I am, and we hang up. I eye the window again.
Are you okay?
Cash leans against the kitchen doorway, his hands in his pockets. I'm fine. Just tired. I smile weakly.
Ah. Follow me.
Cash lends me his bed and sleeps on the love seat, despite my protest that I'm shorter and would be more comfortable. He hands me two neatly folded blankets, and we stand awkwardly, the dividing sheet in Cash's thick fist. His face is a mask I can't read. Do you have a gun? I ask. I'm wondering about the door again, if someone could find me here. if the man in the baseball cap is actually a threat.
No, I don't. But I have a baseball bat.
He smiles, too flippant for the situation. If they come, they'll have guns. I hold the blankets against my chest, nervously twisting my wedding ring.
I'll keep watch. Don't worry, okay?
You need to sleep. He nudges me toward the bed. His room is soft. Worn woods, a weathered rag rug, and a yellow incandescent light give the room a cabin-like feel despite the street noise. I can hear him rustling around, mere feet away, nothing but the sheet to divide us. The wall opposite the bed is exposed brick, each painted a different color, and the overall picture is a rudimentary sun in shades of orange and reds. It seems much too feminine for him to have done himself. The rays are curled around each brick, vine-like and intricate. I make up the bed and climb inside. I fall asleep in my clothes, staring at that sun, wishing for all the world that it gave off some warmth. I sleep in fits and starts, shooting up straight every half hour at every car that starts, every door that slams, never sure if the noise is real or imagined. My dreams are vivid and violent. Evelyn carrying babies in a tattered dress like a zombie, Caroline running from a burning building, Henry shot and bleeding on the floor of Cash's apartment. At 5, I realize I'm famished and wander out to the kitchen. I find Cash's kitchen cabinets and refrigerator well stocked with coffee, eggs, bread. I work quietly, using only the stove light so as to not wake Cash, who snores like an old steam engine from the love seat. While I work, I examine my options. I can't stay here with Cash. I could probably call Lydia, but I can't shake her "I told you so" face when I tell her Henry went to Japan. I can't stomach the idea of painting a rosy picture of my marriage either. No, better to just leave it alone for now. Cash, with his unassuming open-ended questions, is easier. Henry will come home today, and I check my phone, wondering why he hasn't called. He should have landed. When the sun rises, I plan to go to the police station, meet with Officer Yates, figure out what is going on. I resign myself to the fact that today is the last day I will fully live under the guise of Zoe Whittaker. Hillary Lawler has been an apparition in my mind for 5 years, existing only subconsciously. The jig is up. Henry will know my past, my drug use, Evelyn. Some of it I can keep hidden. Certainly the details are mine to spare. My throat closes up with shame at the mental snapshots, stealing pills, those shiny, glistening moms so perfect it hurt, those giant $1,000 wobbling prams, legs piled like matchsticks in the backseat of a car, me, drunk on whiskey, falling in the street while Mick and someone else held me up, Evelyn, abandoned in a morgue cooler, that I left my mother's body to rot. I've never listed it all out, not even to myself. My sins are smaller, less significant, and more manageable if they remain in their individual compartments. Henry won't understand any of it. He's never been poor, desperate, lost. Henry, above all else, has always been consistently, unflinchingly found, certain, linear. I think of Joan, then, my sister tucked in her childhood bed only about 10 miles away. If I truly believe I am in danger, that someone has come back for me, then so is she. We're twins, the same faces mere miles apart. It's a reach, but it worries me. I can't help but feel a small thrill that soon I will meet her. Then a stab of fear that my life will smear into hers, that whoever is after me will somehow find her first. Because I know now there is someone. Some nameless, faceless person who is watching me, coming for me. I have no idea what they want. All I can do is wait. I can't fix Evelyn. I can't go back and make right what I've done. I left her, first to die, then to rot. The woman who loved me, raised me. I could never right those two wrongs. I think of Caroline with a sweet baby boy, 6 years old, with sticky hands, gap teeth, and shaggy hair. She is a mother now, a real one this time, with responsibilities, playdates, and schedules, kindergarten, and t-ball. Whoever called Caroline is watching me. I can't shake the feeling that I'm being monitored. They could find Joan. It's possible. Technology has made everything so incredibly possible. The world is smaller than it's ever been. I calculate the distance between Cash's apartment in the village and Bay Ridge, Brooklyn. It's not far. 25 minutes by cab, maybe? My heart picks up speed. Cash wanders into the kitchen at 7 as I'm sipping my third cup of black coffee. My eyes feel tacky behind the lids, sore and scratching.
So, today will you call your sister?
He opens his mouth wide, half yawning, half stretching. More than that. I'm going there. I run my fingertip along the lip of the coffee cup. He covers his surprise.
Really? When?
As soon as this coffee kicks in.
Why?
I haven't been entirely truthful with you. I stand up, blow out a breath, sit back down. When I lived in California, I got mixed up in some really terrible things. I was a mess. I did drugs. I even sold drugs.
I can't tell you how this blows my mind.
Cash smiles. He stands up and retrieves a plate of cinnamon rolls from the refrigerator and motions for me to take one. You don't seem shocked. I tuck one foot under my leg, touch the icing with my index finger. It comes away white and sticky.
Zoe, a lot of people do drugs. Sell drugs, clean up their lives, change their lives. It's really not that shocking.
I turn this over. The idea that maybe the life I've been desperate to bury under layers of silk Chanel isn't as awful as I'd thought. I'm a different person. Sometimes I think maybe that person didn't exist. Or, at least I wish she didn't. She wasn't a particularly good person, I don't think.
You're too critical. Young people do stupid things. It's the basis for every coming-of-age romantic comedy I've ever seen. It's the plot of most novels. The basis for a zillion rock songs.
I say nothing. Being forgiven for my choices has never been an option. I pull a piece of gooey iced roll apart and pop it in my mouth. It melts on my tongue, perfectly flaky and sweet. Holy shit, did you make this?
Give me a break, he says, his mouth twisted in a smirk. My father was a baker. I learned from the best.
It's amazing. I pull another piece and chase it with a swig of hot coffee. Sitting here in this cozy kitchen in the dim light of morning, I feel comfortable. Accepted. Anyway, I wasn't done. I ratted out what ended up being a high-profile sex trafficking ring. I testified in a grand jury and was threatened. Nearly killed because of it. That's why I ran. Changed my name, left everything behind. Left Evelyn. The words slide out almost easily, these words that I haven't said to anyone in 5 years. It's surprising. Cash has a stillness about him that begets confessions, like the bulk of his body can absorb shocking words, pulling them away from the source, the way a tributary shunts water. It's why I told him about Evelyn in the first place, back in the car.
You think they're back?
These men who threatened you? Cash asks softly. I really do. I know it sounds crazy and I can't prove it. Officer Yates was looking into it after the first break-in. I called the old detective from the case, but he's retired and the case is old and things get lost. I shrug. But now, I'm certain of it. The careening car, the missing credit card, my ransacked apartment, and the break-in last night? It's all too coincidental. I can't shake this feeling. And all when I'm finding Caroline, too. Then she gets this threatening phone call?
What do you mean?
I don't know. I push my palm flat and hard against the tabletop. I can't explain it. I just feel like this is all connected somehow. I have to call Yates back today. I have to find my sister. Maybe warn Caroline. This is all on me. I've brought these people to their doorsteps. Maybe.
Zoe, you're being way too hard on yourself. Do you hear you? None of this is your fault. Everyone has a past. In some ways, everyone runs from them. Maybe not literally. He gives me a gentle grin. What could they want from you after all this time? Do you think they want revenge?
I'm not sure, but it's scaring me. I feel like I could jump out of my skin. I rub my arms, trying to get warm. I stand up and fill his coffee cup absently.
I could get used to this. What's your fee?
Cash laughs. Oh, you can't afford me, I joke lightly, then wince at the perceived truth in that. I shake my hands loose. Did you paint the sun in your room?
My little sister did. She said I needed some light in my life.
He scratches his cheek and leans back in his chair. Some light?
Oh, that came out more melodramatic than I wanted. It was right after Mary. I was in a permanent bad mood most days.
He smiles and sips his coffee, raising his eyebrows.
Hey, this is good.
We sip in silence until he breaks it.
Do you want me to come with you?
I think about it. No, I don't think so. I think I can take a cab there.
If you're right and you're a target, should you be alone?
What will you do, I tease. Carry your baseball bat around?
Point taken.
He raises his cup to me.
Call me right after, okay? I'll be worried.
And curious, you are a reporter. I give him a sly smile.
I admit, I'll be curious, but more than that, I'll be worried.
Sure, sure. But first, I wipe my palms on my jeans. I need to call Yates.
I don't know, Zoe.
Yates's voice huffs through the line, soft and kind, but doubtful.
It seems like a stretch. Everything you're chalking up to one person could all be coincidence, or even yawing bad luck.
Did you look up Michael Flannery, Jared Pritchett? Remember what they did to me? My voice hitches higher and higher, and I can feel the screech in my neck, my throat. I take two deep breaths. I'm just pissed. I want to be believed. I want someone to say I'm not overreacting. Someone to say it makes sense. They'll look into it, help me, that I'm not crazy. Are you sure there was no one at the apartment? She sighs into the phone, a defeated, heavy, empty sound.
There was no one there. No one saw anything. No one heard anything.
Can you dust for prints? My thoughts spin, seeking something to latch onto.
We didn't, Zoe.
I hear the din of the office die down, and I wonder if she's taken the phone into an interview room for privacy. I'm now a call that warrants privacy.
First of all, prints are only good enough if we have someone to compare them to.
That hallway has seen the building's staff, repairmen, yourself, Henry. There was no evidence at the door that there was even an attempted break-in. Because we ran, I protest. Cash peeks out from the living room and mouths, okay? I wave him away. Cash was there. He'll give a statement.
I know, Zoe. I believe you. I do. But look, it's a resource problem. You say a man was outside your door. He didn't do anything, didn't take anything. We have no evidence that he was there. We can't send techs out to dust for prints and process them through the lab when there are real crimes being committed all over Manhattan. Can you see that?
I'm being pursued. I know it. I dig my nails into the soft denim on my thighs until I feel the sharp tang of pain.
Zoe, I wanted to tell you this last night, but then you called me and the attempted break-in took precedence.
Her voice lowers a register until I can barely understand her.
I looked up Michael Flannery. I don't know how to say this, but I couldn't find any record of him in the system.
What? Her words make no sense, this looming, untenable feeling like I'm about to be harpooned and left as chum for circling sharks.
Your guy, Mick,
she coughs nervously into the phone.
Zoe, he doesn't exist.
I cross 14th Street and hail a cab. I pull the index card out of my purse and huff the address across the divider to the cabbie. The East River is in front of me, wide and almost dark green in late morning sun. Within minutes, the cab is crossing the Brooklyn Bridge, speeding through those iconic double stone arches, surrounded by ramrod cables, so thick and straight that if I squint my eyes, they look like prison bars. I think of the mysterious Mick, so elusive now, so present in my mind. Yates said she could find no record of him in prison, in the system, now or ever. He wasn't living in San Francisco. She couldn't find a man with that name and approximate age anywhere in the United States. He was a ghost. A phantom. Phantoms can slip in and out of your life with ease. Nothing she said was a comfort. If anything, the fear had worked its way down into my heart, and my stomach flipped and gurgled. I still felt the connection between the strange events of the past 2 weeks, as real and tangible as though they were tied together with metal cables. But even Cash seemed skeptical. How do you convince someone of an unlikely truth, even if you know it down deep in your bones? You don't. Mick was always less of a concern than Jared, with his shock of black hair, his black eyes, pale skin, the bulging scar that ran from his forehead to his chin, the smell of his breath hot and sour on my face, the feel of his hands on my arm, twisting behind my back, Rosie's pink, shining lip glistening with the word Jared in black ink. A man who will brand a teenage girl will think nothing of tracking down the woman who put him in jail only to kill her. Terrify her, then kill her. Mick was never a ringleader. He was a user of both people and drugs. He was lost, like me. Did Jared kill Mick, and now he's after me? Bay Ridge, a neighborhood in Brooklyn, sits in the loop between Gowanus and Shore Parkway, punctuated at the bottom with the Verrazano Narrows Bridge, like a happy exclamation point. Exit here. I wonder how long she's lived here, if she commutes to Manhattan. If so, have we been to the same stores, the same hair salons? What would have happened if we'd seen each other? Would we have gotten the same haircut, switched places like a Haley Mills movie? I would be Sharon, she could be Susan. I imagine biting my nails to match hers, exchanging wardrobes. Although we've lived mere miles apart, it might as well be 1,000. New Yorkers are shockingly local. If it's not available within a 3-block radius, it simply no longer exists. We like to walk everywhere. Even subway rides are inconvenient. I once overheard a man in a coffee shop refer to his girlfriend as a long-distance relationship because she lived on the Upper East Side and he lived in the Village. There were just too many train connections. You can forget anyone who commutes in from Jersey. Brooklyn and Manhattan are like different states. The cab pulls onto 77th Street and parks in front of a tan-painted Cape Cod, almost gingerbread-like, with a brick facade and a cemented-over front yard. It looks well cared for, surrounded by a black iron fence. I pay the cabbie and climb out, taking a deep breath at the gate. The hedges are neatly trimmed and the window boxes have bright, bursting flowers. Too bright for April. Pinks and yellows, daisies and spring mums. It's much too early for so much bloom. In front of me, looking solemn and kind with her arms outstretched in welcome, stands a concrete bathtub Mary. She's beautiful, ensconced in a periwinkle shrine, two clam-shelled cherubs at her feet. I look up and down the street, more houses with two bright flowers, more Madonna statues. The flowers, I realize too slowly, are silk. I ring the bell, and from inside calls a voice. Hang on! A woman opens the door. Big hair, dark skin, long nails, probably 60-ish. She visibly pales and yells into the house without taking her eyes off me. Bernie! Bernie! You better come here! She opens the door for me, wide so I can pass her without waiting for me to speak. I scoot past her awkwardly. The front hallway is red deep-pile carpet, with a tin-covered radiator acting as a hall table. The whole house smells like meatloaf. Until this moment, I never knew I wanted to live in a house that smelled like meatloaf. A man ambles in, sweaty and red-faced, the sort of man who people might call jolly. He sports a yellow-white ribbed tank top tucked into plaid belted shorts. He pushes his thinning hair back and blinks at me. Hi, my name is Zoe, and I know who you are. She cuts me off and wanders into the living room, sinking into a chair.
Damn near gave me a heart attack, you did. But I know who you are.
Bernie stares at me. His fat little fingers keep pushing that one strip of hair against his red scalp again and again. He peers at me, blinking, with giant gray, watery eyes.
God damn, you look just like her.
I'm Joan's twin? I'm looking for Joan? My statements come out like questions. A fan whirls overhead, and I can hear somewhere in the kitchen the distant calls of a baseball game on television.
Patrice, did you invite her to sit down? Get a drink of water?
Bernie tears his eyes away from mine for a second and glares at his wife. She shakes her head.
I didn't do anything, Bern. I can hardly think. You want a glass of water or something, dear? I just made pizzelles. They were for Lorraine's baby shower, but... my God, that recipe makes so much!
She ambles into the kitchen, and Bernie and I are left alone. He coughs once.
I know. I'm staring at you. I just can't help it. You look so much like my little girl. We've known about you and talked for years about maybe looking you up. But Pat's had a hard time, and we weren't sure. You probably had a family. Who knows?
Patrice comes back, extending a glass plate of golden snowflake cookies dusted with powdered sugar, and she shimmies into a chair opposite mine. They both study me, and I shift uncomfortably, reaching for a cookie. They're light, flaky, and sweet, and I close my eyes. For a moment, I want this. These people with their buttery cookies and their quiet homemade dinner in front of the Mets game, and their family baby shower and church bake sales. I feel gypped.
Honey, what can we do for you?
Patrice reaches out, her long nails tapping my knee. Every finger has a gold ring on it.
I'm, looking for Joan.
Is she here? They haven't made one move to get her. Yet Caroline was clear that she lived here with her parents. Bernie and Patrice exchange glances, and she takes my hand in hers.
Honey, I don't know how to tell you this.
Patrice does a quick sign of the cross.
But our Joanie died 3 years ago.
Chapter 22. The room is hot, stifling, and the clock over the mantel starts its song. 3 o'clock.
She's dead? I repeat.
There's a wad of pizzelle stuck in the back of my throat, and I start to cough. Patrice hands me my water glass, and I gulp it, gratefully, wiping a drip from my chin.
She was killed in a hit-and-run. She was a pedestrian, and...
Bernie's voice peters out while his mouth keeps moving. He gives a little shrug, like, it happens.
It's New York, he finally finishes.
She didn't even live here anymore.
Patrice stamps her foot, suddenly bitter, her painted toenails flash inside peep-toe bedroom slippers.
She was married, moved to Manhattan, hardly ever came back.
Bernie pats the couch next to him, and Patrice stands up, relocates. He leans into her and closes his eyes. His lips move almost as though in prayer. Patrice wipes fat tears from under her eyes with her thumb.
I'm sorry, honey. We do pretty good most days. It's been 3 years after all. I never go a day without thinking of her. But I don't cry so much anymore. But you, you're a shock. Just how you look, your mannerisms. It's all our Joanie.
Can you tell me about her? I don't know what I'm looking for, but I can't leave yet.
She was a kind person. That's what everyone at her service said. That she was the kindest person they'd ever met. She'd help anyone, small animals, children. She gave money to the homeless always, anyone with a hat or a bucket or a coffee can. It didn't matter what they were doing. She didn't care.
They're not begging, they're busking. She always said that.
Bernie rocks back on his haunches, his big hands covering his bare knees. He laughs.
I thought it was so naive.
She worked at the library. She had friends. She had a life. Not a big one, but a life, nonetheless.
Patrice waves her finger at me, her mouth twisted in anger.
Then she meets Mr. Fabulous at some library charity event, and poof, she's gone. eloped. Not even a Catholic wedding for her mama. Some big fancy honeymoon in Paris. Paris! She'd always wanted to go to